Let's get started. This is session 366, panel California's Continuing Battle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Let me introduce our panelists. They will speak in this order. First is Kami Wenger. He's an assistant professor of law at Thomas Jefferson Law School in San Diego, California. He's a graduate of Columbia University School of Law, and he was previously employed as a law clerk to the district judge Jack B. Weinstein of the Eastern District of New York and as a litigation associate with Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York City. He is a founding member of the Mormon-themed weblog Times and Seasons and also By Common Consent, which you can find at bycommonconsent.com and timesandseasons.org. Next, we'll have Clark or maybe Clark. Clark Pingree is a Salt Lake City native, resides in Walnut Creek, California, and is the vice president for the Wells Fargo Wealth Management Group in San Francisco, California. That's not you. Clark is a graduate of Brigham Young University with a BS in finance. Clark served in the Canada-Vancouver mission from 1995 to 1997, and Clark is an openly gay LDS man. Finally, we'll have Nadine Hansen. Nadine Hansen is a semi-retired attorney now living in southern Utah. She's a longtime member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. She's been coming to Sunstone and presenting on various issues since 86. Has four kids and five grandkids, and this is probably the most amazing thing of all. Last year, she laid down 3,500 square feet of tile in her new home. So, let's. Are you ready, John? Okay, we'll start with Kami.
As you can see, the Sheraton public speaking facilities are opposed to gay marriage, so this is a problem, but we're working on overcoming this right now. Hopefully, can we hear me? No? Can you hear me now? Cool. It's like a Verizon commercial. All right, so can you still hear me? If you can't hear me, if you can't hear me, raise your hand and wave and say I can't hear you. Can you hello? That's better? Oh, okay. All right, so we'll try this down here again. No? No? All right, perfect. So as everybody's aware, unless you've been living in a cave, recently the California Supreme Court issued an opinion in the In Re Marriage Cases decision. This is extensive litigation relating to same-sex marriages performed under Mayor Newsom in San Francisco. The case itself raises, it's a pioneering case in a lot of ways, and it raises a bunch of interesting questions. Can everybody still hear? Mostly hear? The case itself is an interesting case and raises a bunch of interesting questions and legal issues. I'm going to be focusing, since I'm a law professor, on these legal topics. So to start off with, what exactly does the case do? Because there's a great deal of information that's being circulated, some of which is accurate and some of which is less accurate. The California Supreme Court, in a 4-3 divided decision, held that under the California Constitution, gays and lesbians, because they had been subjected to certain types of harmful treatment, should be considered a protected class under the state constitution. This is a legal finding, which means that they get a certain level of protection, that a certain level of judicial scrutiny is given to laws that would disadvantage gays or lesbians, and as a result, that these laws have to be scrutinized by the court to see whether or not they pass that. It's a complicated constitutional test, but the nutshell version is that the government should have a very good reason for doing what it's doing and not have an easier way to reach the same result without having whatever harms go on at the same time. What the court found is that differential treatment impinges on the same-sex couple's fundamental interest in having their family relationship accorded the same respect and dignity enjoyed by the opposite by an opposite-sex couple. And because of that, and because there was, as the court found, no, we'll get to in a second, no harms to opposite-sex couple relationships by allowing same-sex relationships, as a result, the court invalidated statutory differences which allowed opposite-sex couples to marry while not allowing same-sex couples to marry. Now, as a bit of background, though, California already had the most extensive domestic partnership laws in the country. And so in California, prior to this decision, in fact, same-sex couples could register as registered domestic partners and receive under state law all of the same benefits that they would receive if they were legally married as husband and wife. Domestic partnership relationship is in a lot of ways very similar to a marriage relationship. From a legal perspective, you can get a cancellation of domestic partnership, which is like a divorce. You can't have a domestic partnership with more than one person at a time. It was essentially a very marriage-like form, but it didn't have the word marriage on it. So this was the status of California law. And so what the Supreme Court decision did was it extended this and extended the right of marriage itself, not merely domestic partnership, to same-sex couples. This has, of course, resulted in a firestorm of back and forth of news stories of other things. And I've gotten a bunch of emails from my ward, from family members, and so on, making specific legal claims. And so I'd like to talk about some of these particular specific legal claims. One legal claim, which has been made a lot by board members, by others that you see it in the media, is that this decision, the Henry Marriage Case decision, will mean that churches will have to start marrying same-sex couples even if they don't want to, even if there's something in their doctrine that goes against it. What you hear, and you may be getting emails from your ward members about this, you know, we have to stop this because otherwise the church will be forced to marry same-sex couples in the temple. And that claim is made a lot. I've seen that claim made in emails that I've received. I've pushed back because it's a claim that's incorrect as a matter of law. And so let's talk a little bit about why. And will the case result in forced gay temple marriages? No, it won't. And I think if it would, that would be a potentially legitimate reason for concern. I mean, I can see legitimate reasons why we might say we don't want the church being forced to do things that cut against church doctrine. However, that claim is incorrect. This is straight out of the Henry Marriage Cases decision. This is the decision which everybody is freaked out about. Straight out of the decision. No religion will be required to change its religious policies or practices with regard to same-sex couples. No religious officiant will be required to solemnize a marriage in contravention of his or her religious beliefs. California's Constitution, Article 1, Section 4, in other words, the California Supreme Court, at the same time as saying that same-sex couples have a right to marry under the state constitution, explicitly say that the state constitution says no religious officiant has to officiate in such marriages, no religious institution has to begin doing such marriages. And when you think about it, that makes a lot of sense. The church isn't required to open the temple doors to everybody who's legally allowed to marry. Jehovah's Witnesses are allowed to marry. Do we have Jehovah's Witnesses marrying in the temple? No, we don't. Muslims allowed to marry. And everybody under the sun is allowed to marry, but very few of these people are allowed to marry in the temple. That's because what we're talking about is a right to marry under the civil law, a right to go to the justice of the peace, or for that matter, to a religious organization that does want to marry you. But this is not going to result in this, what is often being alleged, this scenario of the church being forced to have same-sex couples being married in the temple. So when you hear that claim being circulated in your ward, you can say, no, actually there's language straight out of the case that goes exactly against that. Now, one thing which people have said when I've pointed that, and smart people have said when I've pointed that out, is they've said, well, what if the court changes its mind? And, well, the court could, in the future, issue a different ruling. I mean, there's nothing, I can't predict the future. I can't say what the California Supreme Court will or won't do. This part of the In Re Marriage case's decision seems very unlikely to be changed because one thing you learn in law school is you look for the holding of a case, the central statement of what the case stands for. This is linked directly to the holding of the case. Just before the court says gay couples should have the right to marry, they say this is because we don't have these countervening factors. And one of the countervening factors that we don't have is that this isn't going to impinge on religious liberty. And if it was going to impinge on religious liberty, they would have to do separate analysis and see whether they still got to the same conclusion. So this couldn't be changed without rewriting the entire decision. Now, I can't guarantee that will never happen, but it seems like a very unlikely thing to happen, at least in the near future. And in the far future, who knows? We can't predict what courts will do. But it seems, because it's so directly tied to the court's ruling, to the holding, that this is not something which is going to change. So when your ward members tell you in worried tones that this might happen, you can say, no, under the decision as is, it's not going to happen. And it's because this is so directly tied to the court's central holding, it's unlikely to ever happen in any regime where in remarriage cases hold any legal significance at all. Another question, which I've gotten from curious souls of different sorts, is, well, what about polygamy? If the California Supreme Court said gay marriage is allowed, well, what about polygamy? There's a footnote in the case which says, by the way, this doesn't apply to polygamy. So I don't know, usually the first thing I say is I get my scariest look on and I say, only gay polygamy. But but actually, there's a footnote in the case which says no polygamy under this case itself. That footnote is not directly tied to the court's holding, I think, and so it's not outside the normal possibility that that could be changed in a future decision, but at least under the decision as written right now, no, this does not extend to polygamy. You can't walk in with wife or husband number 3 or 4 and say, in a marriage case, right to marry, because the California Supreme Court has said no on that particular issue. Here we get some interesting questions. What does this change? As we've mentioned, California already had the best domestic partnership laws in the country, very strong protections under state law. Under federal law, even if you're a domestic partner in California, and now if you're married in California, the same-sex couple doesn't receive federal benefits. And so you have various federal homophobic Defense of Marriage Acts and so on, which say that if a same-sex couple is married in California, they still don't get the Social Security benefits, the other federal benefits, which they also wouldn't have received with a domestic partnership. And also, states are not required to extend full faith and credit under the full faith and credit clause to same-sex marriages, again, under federal law as it stands now. And so as a result, this doesn't change a lot. I mean, if you look at it, prior to in remarriage cases, same-sex couples could enter into domestic partnerships in California, could get all rights under state law, didn't get any rights under federal law, and didn't have other states have to recognize this. And now, same-sex couples can marry, can get all of the rights under state law, don't get any of the rights under federal law, and other states don't have to recognize it. So, other than the label, the legal status has not really changed significantly. I mean, and of course, for my gay and lesbian friends, this is a big deal on a psychic level, on an emotional level. It's very important to have their relationships recognized as marriages. But on a purely legal level, there has not been a significant change in the way the same-sex couples are treated in California under the law. If you were a registered domestic partner prior to in remarriage cases, or if you were a married couple after in remarriage cases, you have essentially the same bundle of legal rights under California law, under federal law. A couple of interesting wrinkles come up, and I get additional questions from these helpful folks in my ward who are very interested in Proposition 8. And the question that I get is, what about taxes? And does this mean that the church is going to lose its tax-exempt status? And people are very worried about this. The short answer is almost certainly not, but potentially. The major case under federal tax law is Bob Jones versus United States. A charitable organization can lose tax exemption if they are... if they have to serve a public purpose and not be contrary to established public policy, they must be in harmony with public interest, and the institution's purpose must not be so at odds with community conscience as to undermine public benefit. So that's the language out of Bob Jones. This was used by the IRS to actually talk to Bob Jones University and take away their tax break because they were prohibiting interracial dating, and then there was this litigation back and forth. It seems like it could be theoretically possible under Bob Jones University for a court to find that the church's stance completely flies against the community conscience. That's a pretty tough standard to meet, though, and it seems that it would be unlikely for a court to do that. In any case, I don't think my sense is that it would be unlikely for the IRS to even make that sort of bring that action to begin with. The IRS is a relatively conservative, not politically conservative, but just jurisprudentially conservative federal agency. They don't do crazy things in one direction or the other. They pretty much stick to the rule book as it's written, and so it seems extremely unlikely that the IRS would try to bring some sort of action to take away the church's tax exemption because of the church's views on same-sex marriage. If the IRS were to do so, they would have to show that the church was not in harmony with public interest and was completely at odds with the community conscience in a way that undermined any public benefit that they were giving as a charitable institution. People ask the tax questions because, in part, you get these email horror stories circulated about a Methodist church losing their tax, and usually this is all you'll hear in the story. There was a Methodist church who lost their tax break because they refused to marry a gay couple. Ooh. Actually, it turns out that that's a complicated story, and it involves a couple of things. It involves a detail, and I'm not a New Jersey tax law expert, but I had to look up some things on this, and I think I've got it right. If anybody's a New Jersey tax law expert, feel free to weigh in. This was a non-federal case. This is a state case in New Jersey based on a special exemption for not the church, not the normal church religious institutions exemption, but a special property tax exemption for entities that were fully open to the public. And so when the Methodist Church in New Jersey didn't allow lesbian couples to marry, you can't marry in New Jersey, didn't allow lesbian couples to perform a commitment ceremony in their pavilion, they lost a tax break, which was about $200 in state property taxes for this particular pavilion. A couple of things to note there. This was not a same-sex marriage case. New Jersey is not a same-sex marriage state. This was a commitment ceremony that this couple was wanting to schedule there. This was just a provision of New Jersey property tax wrinkles in the New Jersey code. You can't take any lessons out of this, like, oh no, if the court doesn't like same-sex marriage, we're going to lose everything as far as tax exemptions go. Temples aren't open to the public to begin with. This was a pavilion which was fully open to the public, and then the Methodist Church said, sorry, except for the lesbians, which caused them to lose their property tax break. We don't have anything like that in the church, and we're not asking, that I'm aware of, for property tax breaks. And again, this is not a gay marriage case because it's in New Jersey, which is not a gay marriage state to begin with. So it's incredibly limited, and if and when you see it circulated as a horror story, you can say exactly this to point out that, no, this doesn't mean that the church is going to lose its tax breaks. A couple of other questions that I get. There's one wrinkle. How am I doing time-wise? Am I? Okay. A couple of other interesting legal questions. Is the proposed constitutional amendment in California, the Proposition 8, is it itself legal? There's been some interesting litigation on that because you can make the nutshell version, you can make small changes to the Constitution by ballot amendment, but you have to do big changes by constitutional convention. The California Supreme Court, there was a litigation brought on this, and the California Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So for the moment, this is legal going forward. This is not apparently a big enough change that there would have to be a constitutional convention called or other procedural measures taken. Is the church legally allowed to bring volunteers in to do things to organize opposition against same-sex marriage and in favor of the proposed proposition? Generally, yes. Election laws limit charitable organizations in certain ways. You can't specify a certain candidate. You can't say vote for Joe. But as far as legal issues go, charitable organizations have a lot of ability to weigh in on particular issues. And that this appears to be pretty well within the issue side. Nadine might disagree with me, but I think this appears pretty well within the issue side. This is something which the church is weighing in on as an issue rather than an individual candidate, and so that's probably within the church's role legally as a charitable organization. Does this violate church and state? The government is the one that's not allowed to mess with your freedom of religion. So this is not really a church and state problem from a legal perspective. It may be from a moral perspective or an ethical perspective, and so you can look at people, you know, founding fathers who are writing and saying churches should not get involved in politics because this dirties the hands of religious organizations, essentially. Those sorts of arguments carry all sorts of potential validity, but as far as a legal claim that the church should not be doing this as a matter of law, that's a claim which I don't think stands up. One other question which I get a lot, and this is the question that nobody actually knows the answer to. What happens if the amendment passes? What happens to the thousands of same-sex couples who have been married? Does this apply retroactively? Does this annul their marriage? Are they grandfathered in or grandmothered in? And the answer to that one, as far as I can tell, and I've talked to a half dozen law professors on it, nobody knows. There's the potential that this could retroactively nullify marriages. On the other hand, there's the potential that it couldn't, and it would be a case of first impression. We'll see what the court would do with it. The amendment won't have a lot of legal effect. Whether it passes, whether it doesn't. I mean, if it passes, then, again, you lose the marriage label, but you keep the domestic partnership, which is essentially the same from a matter of law, though there's a little bit of a wrinkle there because so many of the clowns who are on the protectmarriage.com website are organizations that have fought against domestic partnership protection and which have said in their own statements on their website that one reason to pass this amendment is so that we can try to roll back those dastardly domestic partnership protections, too. So on the face of it, this amendment wouldn't roll back domestic partnership protections, but it would seem to be as intended as a possible springboard to roll back domestic partnership protections as well. That's not a complete list of legal issues, but I think those are some of the main legal issues that come up in the case. Thank you.
So after hearing that, I'm really glad I'm not on any ward email subscription lists in California. I think my blood pressure would be through the roof all the time. I'm glad to be speaking here at Sunstone today. This is actually only the second time I've presented at Sunstone. And just a short time ago, last October, I shared my thoughts on my eternal identity as an LDS gay man. Some have asked me why I feel the need to speak again on the topic of homosexuality. Shortly after the Seattle Symposium, the God Loveth His Children Seattle panel was posted on YouTube and to date has been viewed 4,372 times. I've received dozens of overwhelmingly positive phone calls and emails from those whom I've known over the years and those whom I don't know at all. It seems the perspectives I shared in Seattle helped others progress frank dialogue amongst LDS families, friends, and loved ones. I'm hopeful my thoughts today will also help to continue uplifting dialogue for all who are reconciling homosexuality with the gospel. My intent is to be a catalyst for open and constructive dialogue in the Mormon community around homosexuality, and specifically today, my perspectives on marriage and homosexuality. I vividly recall the morning of Thursday, May 18th, when I was working in my office in San Francisco. I received an email stating that the California Supreme Court ruled the ban of same-sex marriage as unconstitutional as defined by the California State Constitution. I was overwhelmed with positive emotions when I learned of this news. A remarkable feeling of silent victory overcame me, and it was a feeling unlike anything I'd really ever experienced before. For so long, I was accustomed to being treated differently and secondary as a gay man. Growing up LDS, I was socially conditioned to feel inferior for being gay. My relationship with the church over the past years had often felt like spiritual and emotional domestic abuse. Being told I was loved on one hand, while being blamed for the destruction of morality on the other hand. I'd lived through the 2004 election in Utah, when the Utah State Constitution was amended to exclude legal recognition of any form of same-sex relationships. I'll never forget how degraded I felt when my own state constitution was used as a weapon against me. In summary, I was used to being rubber-stamped as a second-class citizen by both society and government. Even being a new citizen of the state of California, I'd grown accustomed to being told that civil unions were good enough because they were almost like marriage. Sort of like being told to drink out of a separate water fountain, yet wanting the same water. Now I felt normal, except I felt like a normal, accepted member of society. As I read the many news stories over that day, I was deeply moved in a way I'd never really been moved before. For the first time in my life, my government and my society had given me the legitimacy and validation that I'd never received before. I hadn't expected such a grant. I'd grown desensitized to being regarded as 9/10 of a citizen instead of 10/10 of a citizen. What a new and refreshing phenomenon. The overarching irony to this rich experience was, for me, I was not really even in a position to actually take advantage of this ruling and get married myself. However, the enablement of gay marriage went far deeper and was far more meaningful to me than the actual civil contract called marriage. It was my society finally recognizing me as a full human being with the same dreams, the same ambitions, the same challenges, and the same needs as everybody else, regardless of my sexual orientation. I was witnessing history. The days following May 18th continued to be a time when I felt like I was in a state of perpetual elation. I couldn't believe I was actually living in a place where I was being respected fully as a gay citizen. I shared this joy mutually with my friends who were in committed relationships and who were busily making plans to get married. I recall a coworker and a dear friend of mine who recently married her partner of 15 years with their 4 kids by their side. I was moved when on the 10 o'clock news on June 17th, I watched coverage of the first gay marriage in San Francisco of Del Martin, who was 87 years old and wheelchair-bound, and Phyllis Lyon, who was 83. They had been in a committed relationship for 55 years. I doubt they were getting married for the sex. Conversely, how saddened I was to see the coverage of people in opposition to these marriages spewing hatred, waving signs reading, "God hates fags, homosex is a sin, what's next, the legalization of bestiality?" I wondered how these people could hate others for loving each other. Since June 17th, I've rejoiced that I now have a choice to partake of this basic human right if I choose to do so. What a liberating feeling to be given the right to choose the best course for my life rather than letting public polls decide my fate. With the emergence of the court's ruling came harsh opposition in the name of family values and Christianity. As a Christian myself, I found these efforts a hard pill to swallow. From the beginning, it was clear that a ballot measure would be initiated in attempts to overturn this ruling. Sure enough, within a few weeks, those in opposition gathered over 600,000 signatures required to get Proposition 8 on the ballot. If Proposition 8 passes, gay marriage will once again be banned in California, similar to the other 32 states today. As difficult as it was for me to accept, I expected this opposition. I also expected the church to respond in opposition to the California Supreme Court's ruling. I began to prepare myself emotionally for this some type of declaration by the church. Yet I reminded myself that while the church would take a stand, perhaps the church might take a softer approach this time around. After all, after Jeffrey Holland's October 2007 Inside article entitled "Helping Those Who Struggle with Same-Gender Attraction," it seemed to take a proactive rather than a reactive approach to issues involving homosexuality. Quote, "Someone said that if we plant a garden with good seed, there will not be so much need of the hoe. Likewise, if we fill our lives with spiritual nourishment, we can more easily gain control over inclinations. This means creating a positive environment in our homes in which the Spirit is abundantly evident. A positive environment includes consistent private and public worship, prayer, fasting, scripture reading, service, and exposure to uplifting conversation, music, literature, and other media." Close quote. Surely the LDS Church would stand their ground in opposition to gay marriage, but I'd hoped maybe this time they'd err on the side of compassion, love, and tolerance towards people like me who are gay and LDS. They seem to be headed this direction over the past few years. On Sunday morning, June 20th, I awoke to find an email from a friend who'd sent me a copy of the church's letter to be read in every ward in California on June 27th. Devastation sank in as I read this letter. My hopes that the church would show kindness and compassion towards people like me evaporated. I felt like a scapegoat of an organization that I once would have given anything for. I felt betrayed. I was being blamed for the destruction of marriage and the family. I felt like I was thrown under the bus by my church and then backed over a few more times. My dreams and my mortal life and my eternal life are just like those to other members of the LDS Church. I long for companionship. I hope for a family of my own. I aspire for commitment, monogamy, and complete loyalty to a significant other, and God willing, a family. I face similar challenges that other Latter-day Saints face. I fight the same battles as other Latter-day Saints. One difference is that I don't have the support of the LDS Church in fighting most of these battles. In addition, there are more battles I must fight as a gay member of today's society in the face of homophobia, prejudice, and ignorance. To my heartbreak, the Church has perpetuated a document to make these battles harder. The letter read across the wards of California on June 27th, entitled "Preserving Marriage and Strengthening Traditional Families," cut me deeply. As if by its own title, I was being labeled as the enemy of the family. Nowhere in this letter was there any mention of children of God who were gay and the need for members of the church to treat them with love, respect, and tolerance. Instead, implications of the family being placed under attack by gay people saturated this letter. I hurt to contemplate how many gay members of the church have taken their own lives since this letter was read. It pains me to wonder how many more will take their lives as we continue to degrade a group who has already been denigrated by every faction of society. Since I first read this letter, I've been racked with frustration. From May 18th to today, I experienced one of the most positive, validating experiences of my life, followed by one of the most despondent, alienating experiences of my life. I prepared myself knowing I would go from high to low in the blink of an eye. I did, however, hit lower than I originally expected. Feelings of rejections I'd experienced so much in my 20s, as I'd struggled to come to terms with my homosexuality, reemerged in ways I hadn't planned. I wanted to do something to defend myself and others like me, but I didn't know how. The dream of the world being a better place, and specifically my state, with new additions of equality, respect, and mutual understanding, felt as if it was temporary bliss. Logically, I was weighted with many new questions as a result of this letter. Why was the church making such statements in the name of morality? Why wasn't the church speaking out and making official statements on other political issues involving immorality as defined by LDS doctrine? Why was the church aggressively investing resources into this political fight and not other fights of a much greater magnitude, specifically genocide in Darfur, the persecution of the Palestinian people in the Middle East, torture and human degradation at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib, the displacement of tens of thousands from Hurricane Katrina, and the starvation of millions in North Korea? Is gay marriage more of a threat to the fabric of society than these atrocities? I also wondered why this secular issue couldn't just remain in the civil arena where it belonged. Why was it necessary for the church to instruct people on how to vote on a political issue? The church views marriage as more than a civil contract. But what about those who are not members of the LDS Church who do view marriage as secular? I fully respected the church's right to declare their stand on gay marriage as their own right to choose. I also expected the church to respect my stand on gay marriage as an American citizen. To me, legislating one's definition of morality is intruding upon everybody else's freedom of religion. I do not feel that gay marriage is immoral. In fact, I feel quite the opposite. I believe gay marriage will do more for gay people, and just like what it has done for heterosexuals, creating a structure for people to take life to a higher level of commitment, a higher level of accountability, and a higher sense of being. I believe gay marriage will offer the much-needed protections of spouses and children that are not offered through civil unions or less. I also feel gay marriage will reduce sexual promiscuity and reduce the transmission of HIV. Spiritually, I feel gay marriage is morally and socially responsible. Last but not least, gay marriage will encourage people like me to stop marrying your heterosexual daughters. Gay people will engage in romantic relationships regardless of what the laws say they can or can't do. Why not give them a reason to be accountable to a relationship that already exists? As a final footnote, the state of California also estimates gay marriage will generate an additional $64 million in tax revenue. For a state on the fringe of fiscal insolvency, what a nice financial value proposition. Before I conclude, I call your attention to a historical parallel that we as society should be cognizant of. History has proven that time and time again, marriage is not clearly defined. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 specifically banned marriages of Chinese people to American people. The marriage ban was later repealed in 1943. The Edmund Act of 1882, specifically designed to attack early Latter-day Saints, redefined marriage as monogamous. Interracial marriage in the U.S. was once a long, drawn-out battle, much like gay marriage is today. Until 1967, interracial marriage was technically illegal in the United States. Ironically, in 1883, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Pace v. Alabama that a ban on interracial marriage was in fact constitutional. Yet in 1967 in Loving v. Virginia, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled laws banning interracial marriage to be a violation of the 14th Amendment. When the U.S. Supreme Court announced its ruling, similar outcry surfaced, exactly as we see today in California and across the United States. Many religious groups in America campaigned against interracial marriage, calling it immoral and the destruction of the sanctity of marriage. In 1871, Representative Andrew King became the first politician in Congress to propose a constitutional amendment to make interracial marriage illegal. In December 1912 and January 19th, Representative Seaborn Roddenberry introduced a proposal in the U.S. House of Representatives to insert a prohibition into the U.S. Constitution banning interracial marriage. Roddenberry compared interracial marriage to the enslavement of white women and warned of future civil war that would ensue if interracial marriage was not made illegal nationwide. Quote, "No brutality, no infamy, no degradation in all the years of Southern slavery possessed such villainous character and such atrocious qualities as the provision of the laws of Illinois, Massachusetts, and other states, which allow the marriage of the Negro Jack Johnson to a woman of Caucasian strain. I offer this resolution that the states of the Union may have an opportunity to ratify it. Intermarriage between whites and blacks is repulsive and averse to every sentiment of pure American spirit. It is abhorrent and repugnant to the very principles of Saxon government. It is subversive of social peace. It is destructive of moral supremacy. And ultimately, this slavery of white women to black beasts will bring this nation a conflict as fatal as ever reddened the soil of Virginia or crimsoned the mountain paths of Pennsylvania. Let us uproot and exterminate now this debasing, ultra-demoralizing, un-American, and inhuman leprosy." Close quote. We now look back on such measures and wonder why we were so foolish. I also believe we will look back on the debate on same-sex marriage and ask ourselves the exact same question. I think we've seen miraculous progression in our society with accepting homosexuality at its face value. We're treating people like me with more respect, we're gay-bashing less people like me, and we're even attempting to protect the basic human rights of people like me. I continually hope that all members of society, LDS people included, will realize the benefits of respect, protection, and fellowship to people like me. I hope that members of society will be more considerate of my dreams, my ambitions, and my feelings as a fellow American and also as a brother in the gospel. I dream of the day when we can all be one church and one America without distinction to one's sexual orientation.
In listening to those quotes about interracial marriage, I recall that Brigham Young's idea about relations between the sexes was death on the spot. And I also wanted to note that the California Supreme Court, in reaching this decision, did rely heavily on a California case, I believe it was Perez, which had declared that a ban on interracial marriage violated the California Constitution. And this was, I think, maybe a couple decades before, or at least a decade before, Loving versus Virginia. I had just a couple comments I wanted to make also about Kaimi's comments. Regarding tax-exempt status, one difference between the Bob Jones University case and the church's situation is that Bob Jones is a university, not a religion. It's a religious university, but it's still a university, and its tax exemption falls under some different rules than does a church. Until churches are required, such as the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church, are required to ordain women, I wouldn't worry about them losing their tax-exempt status over their refusal to recognize gay marriage. So I think that's pretty much a red herring for the foreseeable future, for your lifetime and mine. Now, as for my prepared remarks, I can't resist beginning with an "I told you so." Back in 1996, I was on a panel at Sunstone called Patriarchs and Politics, from the ERA to the Proclamation on the Family. And my task in that panel, in part, was to talk about the Proclamation on the Family, which had just been issued the prior September, so it was new. In doing so, I said that as far as I could tell, the way people were hearing the Proclamation on the Family, people in my ward, people I knew, they heard it as this warm, fuzzy document that affirmed these strong, loving families that we all want to have. But I said that there was an underlying subtext in the proclamation on a topic that is never mentioned in the proclamation, and that's homosexuality. I said that certain aspects of the proclamation, this is a quote, are a clear statement that church leaders intend to resist any further societal legitimization of homosexual relationships. And I noted the political language at the end of the proclamation, and then I talked a little about some of the reasons that I thought they issued the proclamation when they did. And in particular, at that time, they had tried to intervene in a case in Hawaii. By intervention, that's more than filing a friend of the court brief. It's saying to the court, our interests are so affected by this litigation that we should be a party to this litigation. And the Supreme Court in Hawaii disagreed with them. But the church did try very hard to be a party in that litigation. And not long after that, they started asking people in California to write legislators about a measure that was pending there about homosexuality, and also in Hawaii. So later, after I did this, in a missive to my state president, the church, some anonymous person in the church took, some anonymous member of the church structure in a directive to my state president took exception to my suggestion that this was a political document to fight homosexuality. But in the more than 12 years now since the proclamation came into existence, I am unaware of any time or circumstance under which the church has urged members or government leaders to enact a single measure to strengthen the family other than legislation that would undermine homosexual relationships. So I feel vindicated. The language in the proclamation says, "We call upon responsible citizens and officers of government everywhere to promote those measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of society." Now, I want to go back and talk a little bit about some history about the church's involvement in politics, and I'm going to go back to the time of the Equal Rights Amendment, and then talk about the Knight Initiative, which was California's previous gay marriage issue. So back at the time when the church was fighting ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, it ratified in California ratified it very early, so I didn't really personally see any of this happening. But in Virginia, where the legislature looked like it might ratify, the church held meetings and they told people to write letters and they bused women to the legislature and they raised money. They actually raised money in California and funneled it to Virginia to fight the ERA there. And I know that because I was supplied with fundraising forms from the state of Virginia, and I found a stake directory in California and was able to identify that almost all of the donors were Mormons. But when they told people to lobby, to write letters, they always told them, "You're not acting on behalf of the church. You're just acting as individual private citizens. Don't say that you're members of the church." At the time, it was obvious to those of us who saw what was happening that the Special Affairs Committee of the church was orchestrating this. And President Hinckley, he was not president of the church then, but he was head of the Special Affairs Committee, and I saw him go on television and say that the church doesn't get involved in politics, and that it's just our church members acting as individuals. And at the time, he was running the anti-ERA campaign. Now, fast forward to the Knight Initiative in 2000. This is the law that the California Supreme Court just overturned. Correct, Amy? Yeah. And by this time, I had moved away from California, but I still had a lot of moles there. And I learned that church leaders in Salt Lake had sent out directions telling local leaders that church, they should raise money and work for Passage of the Night Initiative, but I didn't have any access to the document. And church members were being told, I knew that they were being told that they needed to support this legislation in order to follow the prophet. And in fact, my son's state president went so far as to tell him that President Hinckley had had a revelation that the church should fight gay marriage and that members should support that. And then one weekend, I was contacted by Jenny Grundine, who is a reporter at KUER, which is Salt Lake's National Public Radio affiliate. And she was working on a story, and she'd been talking to church PR people and to some others at church headquarters. And they were consistently telling her that Salt Lake was not involved in supporting the Night Initiative. And she called me up and she said, could it be that these people in California are just acting on their own? She had a specific person who she was referring to. And I said, listen, when it comes to this issue, he can't wipe his nose without permission. But I still couldn't prove it. Well, eventually, over this weekend, she found the document. Someone gave it to her. She told me he was very fearful. He didn't want to be known as the person who leaked it. But he had given it to her, so I said, okay, here's what you do. You talk to Brother So-and-so. This is what I do when I cross-examine a cop on the stand. First of all, I marry him to his report. I make him say that he knows how important it is to write a report, and he knows it's important to be accurate, and he knows it's important for it to be complete. And after I get him thoroughly committed to that report, then I start asking him questions to show how inaccurate and incomplete the report is. So what you need to do is you need to marry Brother So-and-so to his position that the church is not orchestrating this campaign in California, and then tell him you've got the paper. So she called me back a few hours later, and she said, I did what you said. And after I told Brother So-and-so that I had the paper, he got very quiet, and then he said, I need to go, and I'll call you back. So I said, all right, there are three things he can do, that the church can do. They can continue to lie in the face of the evidence, or they can come clean, or they can hang Brother So-and-so out to dry and say that he was just acting on his own. Well, they did come clean, and they admitted that they were involved. And the next morning, I listened to her report, and I don't think she was the one saying the words, but they told that church leaders had first denied and then had admitted their involvement. And now, about this same time, the church itself, rather than raising money from its members, from church funds, they made a contribution of $500,000 to an anti-gay rights or gay marriage and campaign in the state of Alaska. Now, fast forward to February 2008. Peter Danzig, you may have read about him in the paper, he was a former member of the orchestra at Temple Square. And he resigned his membership rather than be excommunicated over a letter to the editor that he had written opposing the church's opposition to gay marriage. After he left the church, then the church posted their sort of defense of their actions on their website. And this is what they said. In his Tribune letter to the editor, Mr. Danzig said that he was, quote, troubled that my church requested I violate my own conscience to write in support of an amendment I feel is contrary to the Constitution and the Gospel of Christ. End of his quote, but continuing the quote on the church website, and this is the important part. In reality, church leaders had asked members to write their senators with their personal views regarding the federal amendment opposing same-gender marriage and did not request support or opposition to the amendment. And now, 4 months later, fast forward to late June, and by this time, the Mormon blogosphere is alive with the announcement that the church is going to read this letter in California and in sacrament meeting. And I got the text of the letter several days before it was going to be read. And I talked to somebody yesterday who told me his bishop didn't get it until the night before it was supposed to be read. So I had it before he did, before at least one bishop did. And then the Salt Lake Tribune ran a story on it, and the church then posted it on the internet. Now, the June letter drops all pretense of asking members to act according to their own conscience. This is what it says. We ask that you do all you can to support the proposed constitutional amendment by donating of your means and time to assure that marriage in California is legally defined as being between a man and a woman. Our best efforts are required to preserve the sacred institution of marriage. So in other words, between February, when they said that Danzig was just asked to express his views, and June, when they told California Mormons what they were supposed to do, the church reversed its approach, now exalting institutional imperative over individual conscience and possibly raising the stakes for Mormons of conscience who support same-sex marriage. The idea that the church, well, the church is still kind of doing some of the same things in terms of having people say that they're just acting on their own behalf. And this is something that was recently posted on the internet. And this is a man who is telling you about what happened in priesthood meeting. My second complaint, his first complaint was that politics is dirty and the church really would be better off not getting involved in it. My second complaint is that the church needs to admit that members acting pursuant to its promptings are acting on its behalf. The instructions we received in priesthood was that when canvassing the neighborhood, we were not to go in twos, wear white shirts and ties, or do anything that would make us look like Mormons. Instead, we were to make it clear that we were acting on our own as individual concerned citizens and not on behalf of the church. I think that's a bit deceptive. If the church is going to strongly urge its members to support the proposition, then it needs to take responsibility for the things those members may do. That's what he wrote. So, why the secrecy? Well, I can't read the minds of the church leaders, but since they don't tell us why, I'm going to speculate. Possibly they don't want to appear to be too involved because they fear having their tax-exempt status challenged. This would be a different reason for losing their tax-exempt status than not recognizing gay marriage. This would be losing their tax-exempt status for being too political. I did some research on this back at the time of the Knight Initiative, and what I found was that it's an ambiguous point, but unless an organization, a tax-exempt organization, uses a substantial amount of its resources to lobby on political issues, then they're safe. Well, so if you're a poor organization, you don't have very much money, you can't spend very much. But if you're a rich organization, you can really spend quite a lot without getting into trouble. So I don't think that's going to be a problem for them. But it might be one concern. And maybe it's fear that they will alienate prospective members. Or maybe it's just a habit in a church where the hierarchy makes the decisions and the members follow. One question raised by this directive is what's going to happen to members who choose to conscientiously oppose the church's position? Will they be socially or ecclesiastically marginalized? Will they lose their temple recommends? Will they, as happened to my son during the Knight Initiative, be put on super secret double probation, or disfellowshipped, or excommunicated, or encouraged to resign, as Peter Danzig did? There's an email circulating around the internet that purports to be a conversation that someone had with Apostle Jeffrey R. Holland. And he told this person, reportedly, that no one would be disciplined or lose their temple recommend over opposition to the church's position over this issue. But I have heard anecdotally of one person who has been asked to surrender his or her temple recommend. The issue is personal for me. I no longer live in California, but I have children who do. And very soon, my daughter's involvement in setting up a pro-gay marriage website is going to become quite public. The website, in case you would like to look at it, is mormonsformarriage.com. And it respectfully and rationally makes a case for why Mormons should support same-sex marriage, and I'm very proud of her contribution to it. In the coming months, we're going to see tens of millions of dollars raised and spent in California over one word, because really, this decision focuses on one word, marriage. As Kayumi said, the substantive rights are going to pretty much stay the same either way. The majority and dissenting justices agree that California already protects the substantive rights of same-sex partners. So anyone who doubts the power of words need only look to California and to all the money that's going to be spent over the word marriage. So now let me ask a question of how that money might be better spent to, as the Proclamation on the Family says, promote measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as a fundamental unit of society. What if the money supported a measure to enact a system of premarital counseling to help people make informed decisions as they enter marriage, and of low-cost postmarital counseling to help couples in crisis resolve disputes and strengthen their marital commitments? What if it supported a measure to provide universal health care so that families will never be devastated by the leading cause of bankruptcy in America, high medical expenses? What if it supported a measure to allow paid maternity leave so that women who work could afford to stay home for a while with new babies to help them get off to a good start in life? What if it supported a measure to provide daycare to families, or job sharing, or part-time work with full-time benefits so that parents could spend more time with their children? What if it supported measures to help people whose good jobs have gone overseas and who need retraining for comparable jobs in the new economy? What if it supported measures to provide better prenatal care and a cleaner environment to help children be healthier? What if it supported conservation measures and alternative energy to mitigate the horrible impact that the high cost of energy is imposing and will impose this winter on struggling families? I'm not saying that all these suggestions are necessarily doable or that they're necessarily good public policies, but are not the underlying problems they address moral issues? And would not addressing them have a much greater potential to maintain and strengthen families as a fundamental unit of society than whether or not gay people call their unions marriage?
Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we don't have time for questions and answers. But thanks again to the panel.